I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about movies. We're going to talk about the good, the bad, and the indifferent among the year's films. We'll talk about favorites and disappointments, about the hits and the flops, and we'll talk about unnoticed gems. My guests will be a couple of old friends of No Limits, WFYI film critic Matthew Sosi and Nouveau film critic Ed Johnsonott. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or finding us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu. And by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about movies today on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@nolimitswfyi.org. I screwed that up. My apologies. Or you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, my guests are two old friends of the program. I almost feel like you guys, we should do that, you know, opening Saturday Night Live skit where you get the goofy dinner jackets and all the smoking jackets and play Tom Hanks and Steve Martin and Alec Baldwin. Matthew Sosi, WFYI's film critic, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, John. And Film Sociology, Fridays and at film 5 sociology. On WFYI HD2.
And Ed Johnsonott, who is Nouveau's film critic. Welcome
going
back.
Into my 18th year. Thank you, John.
It's good to have both of you here. Well, let's just start with kind of the overview and then drill down a little bit. Good year or bad year for the movies? I'll let Matthew go first.
Well, it's funny. Ed and I were talking about this before the show. There is a calendar, a film critic calendar. January through like March, it's a combination of Oscar contenders that are finally coming to Indianapolis and movies that the studios just need to put something out. Mm-hmm. And during that time, it can be a wasteland. So we're waiting for the summer blockbuster season, which now starts in May and goes through July. And so we got the summer movies. Then we have a bit of a wasteland, August, September, and then October through December is what we call grown-up movie season, the Oscar contenders. Mm-hmm. Well, this year's summer was really disappointing, and then the last 3 months, we have been hit with quality film after film after film. It's a good problem to have that it was just one excellent film right after another for the last couple of months.
So to sum up, on at least from your perspective, and I'm going to ask Ed the same question. Disappointing year for the blockbusters, the big summer films.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But we're closing a little bit strong with, you know, with movies for people over the age of 12.
I look at my ones that don't make the top 10, and I feel bad for them. I'm like, that's a good sign.
Yeah.
So, Ed, what do you think? Good year, bad year?
Good year. And a few great ones. Lots and lots of good ones.
We've already gotten a message, a listener message from Facebook. This is from a listener named Michael. And by the way, if you want to find us on Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. Says my two favorite film critics for the last 20 plus years have been Roger Ebert and Edward Johnsonott. I don't go to see or rent a movie if one of these guys don't like it. Life's too short to watch bad movies. And now that Roger is gone. EJO is the man.
It's all
Roger
on you, Ed. On.
I can't That's bear it. The responsibility.
Okay. So that means he'll be doing the Beyond the Valley of the Dolls 3 screenplay.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. Since we want to close this show on a high note, why don't we talk about the bad first, okay, and get that out of the way.
Now, what I do every year, I never do the worst films because who cares? You know, I do the most annoying films.
Okay,
because it's more interesting.
What's the most or the most annoying films?
One of them, and this is the one that will stir people up, but Now You See It. It was a massive hit about a band of magicians that were staging heist. If you're going to do magic in a movie, you have to establish your internal reality or your internal logic. If there's going to be magic, then that's fine. But if they're living in our world and they're doing tricks, then you've got to stick with our rules. They couldn't resist the temptation to use CGI to have the magicians early in the film doing things that would be physically impossible for any magician on Earth to do, only someone with actual magic powers. And that did, that came in as a factor at the very tail end of the film, which meant they didn't even adhere to their own internal logic once they established it. It just, it was so frustrating. And everybody I know looks at me when I talk about this and go, but it was fun. Well, yeah, but...
Well, stupid fun, I guess, that would be your point. Matthew.
Well, my number one pick, and I wish I had an annoying, but I have a threshold of pain, apparently. Yeah. There was a film not screened for the press called Movie 43, and it was apparently an attempt to make a 21st century version of Kentucky Fried Movie. This was a series of short sketches. And I mean, an all-star cast. You had Hugh Jackman, Kate Winslet, Dennis Quaid, Greg Kinnear, Richard Gere, Terrence Howard. Lots of people involved in this. Even Richard Gere even went to the press and said, this is a terrible film. I don't know if they owed somebody favors, but it's R-rated humor. And two, it's the tradition of taking a joke, running it into the ground, digging it out of the ground, and running it into the ground once again. And the opening sketch has a first date between Hugh Jackman's character and Kate Winslet's character. And I'm going to word this properly. And we find out that Hugh Jackman's character has hanging off of his neck a male body part. And that's the joke. But it goes on for 10 minutes.
Oh,
just not fun at all. If you like R-rated sketch comedy and you're not online, rent Kentucky Fried Movie. That it really should have started and stopped with that one back in the mid-70s. It was just not fun at all. And I don't even know 12-year-olds that would like this. So really unfortunate.
So then we've got the most annoying.
And the Lone Ranger.
Why was that so annoying?
It was inept.
I did not see it.
Grand scale. It just was astoundingly untrue to its characters and just bad and dull. And
you know what? When casting Johnny Depp as an Indian is not even the top complaint, because guess what? That Hollywood did that in the 50s, 60s, and early 70s. Mm-hmm. But you have they treat The Lone Ranger and Tonto like it's a buddy picture. And, of course, it's an early buddy picture. At the beginning, they don't like each other, which means they have to eventually like each other. They make Tonto a smart aleck. Jay Silverheels, I'm sure, would have something to say about that. And then on top of all that, and by the way, it just looks like Pirates of the Caribbean in the Old West.
Right.
It's the same director that worked on those with Johnny Depp. But there's also a bit of storytelling that they lift from The Princess Bride, which involves Johnny Depp's character when he's older and a kid. It was just...
it's terrible. The framing device is terrible. And The Lone Ranger is a twit.
Yeah,
it's like the origin story. He has to grow into being the Lone Ranger, and he doesn't become the Lone Ranger we knew at all in the movie. Mm-hmm. He's still pretty much of a twit at the end.
Yeah, that's just not good choices across the board.
We are talking about movies here, the year in movies on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Or you can find us on Facebook at No Limits, WFYI, or on Twitter at WFYI. Okay, so let's talk then. We've established worst and most annoying. How about the biggest disappointment? I mean, it sounds like Lone Ranger, although I think there were a fair number of people who frankly didn't have real high expectations for that movie anyway.
Man of Steel.
Why?
Yeah.
Why?
He flied for your sins.
Yeah.
Yeah, But to me, it betrayed the character. Superman kills in the movie. And in the 4,000 issues of the comic book, there was a situation where that's happened before. But not, you know, we went from Christopher Reeve and his successors to a sullen, angry, confused Superman who kills and then spends the last, 40 minutes of the film with two guys just smashing each other into buildings.
Yeah.
And property destruction that was way too reminiscent of real-life tragedies.
Yeah, there's a point where there's this, and I don't think we're really giving away a whole much. It's on Blu-ray now. But there's a fight between Superman and Zod, played by Michael Shannon, in which, I mean, when they hit each other, and I think one of my colleagues here, Jim Mueller, made a point of when you have two equally behemoths hitting each other, they're not going to travel 8 city blocks.
Mm-hmm.
If they hit you and I, we would travel 8 city blocks, but mm-hmm. it would be like a heavyweight fight between those two. Plus, there's a scene where they're fighting inside, I think it's a museum, and when a laser is about ready to kill a family, that's when Superman gets angry. Forget about the thousands of people, you know, and the carnage that has happened prior mm-hmm. to this. So they're, part of it is that. I know they're cashing in on the Christopher Nolan Dark Knight series where they want to make, you know, grown-up, serious Superman films. And it works sometimes, but it was I think, a big letdown. Of course, if you try to make Diane Lane a frumpy farm mom, mm-hmm. I got issues with that. That's me personally.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Adam, and if you do want to send us a tweet, you can do so by finding us on Twitter, at WFYI. Adam says, most annoying worst films of the year, 1, Grown Ups 2, 2, oh, A Good Day to Die Hard, 3, he pairs these, Olympus Has Fallen and White House Down.
Okay.
All right.
Oh,
here we
go.
Go
ahead.
Go ahead.
I completely agree with him on Olympus Has Fallen. I don't, actually, it wasn't that terrible, but it wasn't good. White House Down is a it may make my top 10 list. White House Down was an action film where terrorists snatched the president. Both films were that.
Mm-hmm.
They both follow basically the same template, except that White House Down, done by Roland Emmerich, who's clod, he's made some horrible movies, but he knew what he was making, and he made it, you know, he turned the volume level up to 11. He did that with every aspect of the film. Mm-hmm. You have the president and Jamie Foxx and Channing Tatum essentially doing a buddy movie halfway through, mm-hmm. only it works because they know what they're doing and they're just having fun, letting you know that they're having fun with it. I love that movie. And it kind of stiffed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, part of it is it came first, second. It came after Olympus.
Olympus. Yeah.
Olympus Has Fallen has the better cast, Morgan Freeman, Melissa Leo, Gerard Butler, Aaron Eckhart, Robert Forrester. And I wish it had the tone of White House Down, except it took itself so seriously. There
yes.
was no fun in it. Now, I thought White House Down was maybe 20 minutes too long. You can't cast James Woods and not be surprised that he's a turnaround. And there's something that happens to another Academy Award nominated actor playing a character that I think drags the show down. You know, it's like I said, I think the last 20 minutes could have been snipped
but
and sucked easily.
But it's big fun.
It is big dumb fun.
I'm with the caller. Was it Michael?
Adam.
I'm with Adam on everything else.
Yeah, so Grown Ups 2 is...
I missed that one because I think I wound up reviewing something else that week. Oh, darn.
They don't even bother with the... I mean, they just take the characters and they have them go do stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then they're done. And that's all there is to the movie.
So it's like they use the film to fund, you know, excursions for Adam and his pals.
I think if you could hear carefully, you could hear the ghost of Hal Needham and Burt Reynolds going, get a script, guys.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Such a bad
And movie. Then A Good Day to Die Hard, I'm presuming.
I think I missed that one as well. I think
I
reviewed
that one
something
on
else. Oh, darn.
I missed that one deliberately.
I miss having hair John McClane as opposed to bald and serious John McClane. I miss smart alecky receding hairline John McClane.
Well, remember Steve Carell on The Office talking about how the Die Hard series had gone from being a series about an ordinary man in extraordinary circumstances to a show where Bruce Willis is riding a motorcycle out of a plane, you know, and...
That's okay.
I saw Steve Carell last night, by the way, in Anchorman 2.
Yeah.
I attended the sneak preview, and...
How was it?
It's as hit and miss as the first one, but when it hits, it's screamingly funny, especially with Steve Carell's character. It misses a lot for me. The rest of the audience, they were laughing more, but I still had fun. I mean, it's not a good movie, certainly, but whatever... If you like
Brilliant
Anchorman,
marketing campaign.
Yeah, if you like so Anchorman,
yeah.
you know, you'll find enough.
So it's Reggie Jackson, just as many home runs as there are strikeouts.
Pretty much. We are talking about movies here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. We've gotten an email from a listener named Rex who says, Inside, is it Lewin Davis?
Lewin.
Lewin. the best Coen Brothers movie to date.
Ooh.
Thanks, Rex.
I don't agree with that. I don't. But then again, I haven't really compiled a list because I'm married and I have a child and work. But I'm not Jack Black in High Fidelity. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a great deal. I guess maybe I'll have to work on a top 10.
Think about the
Coen Brothers.
The Coen Brothers.
I think is tone. You could have this as a double feature with their film A Serious Man.
Yes,
it's haunted me. It just that film is just I've seen it two times and. Matt and I were discussing it just before we came in fact.
We are talking about movies here on No Limits. My guests are Matthew Soucy of Film Sociology and Ed Johnson Ott, who is Nouveau's film critic. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about movies today. My guests are Matthew Soucy of Film Sociology, WFYI's film critic, and Ed Johnson Ott, who is the Nouveau's film editor. We were talking about, the reason I was sighing is I'm struggling inside, and I it's Llewyn Davis. I have not seen the
two
film
L's
yet.
Trophy.
Yeah, it does. And I thought, okay, I got to think about how I'm going to pronounce that so I don't butcher it again. We were talking about that right before the break.
Llewyn Davis, inside Llewyn Davis, I mean, it hit me hard enough that on a day where we saw three movies in one day, including one that was 3 hours long, I still went to an evening screening of Llewyn Davis because I needed to see it another time. It's profoundly a bummer in the best way, which is an odd thing, you know, but it's set in the early 1960s folk period in New York. I don't want to say folk boom,
but
we really don't see the boom part.
No, but it is pre-Dylan.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Barely.
Okay.
And it follows Llewyn Davis, who almost makes it. He's one of the guys that's almost where he's in the right place, but the right thing didn't happen, and his attitude wasn't right, and and it's fascinating. It's well acted. The cinematography in particular is just beautiful, and the music, which is performed live while you watch it performed on film, is stunning. It's just
I'm with you. I said at the time that it was kind of, I think it was the Coen Brothers version of the story of the tortured artist, whether it's Amadeus or Purple Rain or, you know, and some say this is or isn't based on Dave Von Ronk.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, any tortured artist you can think of, John Lennon, Jim Morrison, you know, the really talented person in which they themselves are the biggest stumbling block.
But they systematically de-romanticize the whole mythos of the struggling artist.
Of the tortured
artist. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is not a fun guy to hang out with, but Oscar Isaac, who plays the lead, is really good in it, and I like the fact that I think the folk generation is like the beat generation, where TV has kind of made that into a punchline, from Maynard T. Cribbs all the way up to
the Beats hated that,
but also, you know, folk music was made fun of, I think, in a nice way, in A Mighty Wind, and I think the Coens really took care to capture early 60s New York, and I think they do it really, really well.
It's not going to be a crowd pleaser.
No.
You know,
but,
people going that saw No Country for Old Men and True Grit going expecting,
it's more like A Serious Man some of the other darker Coen Brothers fare.
But I understand Rex's enthusiasm. It's a fine film, and it's disturbing in a good way.
Mm-hmm. What was the biggest surprise for you guys this year in terms of the one that maybe you didn't have high hopes for that actually you turned out liking?
There's a couple. Actually, there's a couple that come to mind. One, I remember, had an Indiana actor who we've had on the radio before, Tim Grimm. Mm. But it was, you and I saw this, Ed. It was called At Any Price. This was the farm drama with Dennis Quaid, Zac Efron, and it's you know, the first, you think about this on paper, and it sounds like a Heartland Truly Moving Pictures movie. Mm-hmm. And Heartland, you're good sports for letting me compare it. But Quaid is a third-generation farmer. He wants one of his kids to take over the farm. Zac Efron doesn't want to. He wants to race cars. And then we find out that Dad has some questionable practices with selling seeds. And it starts to go down a really, like, a Shakespearean tragic path. And you know, it on paper sounds like a truly moving picture, but it goes really dark,
really dark,
really fast. And the fact that they don't let up, it would have been really easy the last 5 minutes of the film to make this, you know, a twist, a happy ending, or wrap mm-hmm. it in a nice package, and they don't. And mm-hmm. it's, I mean, I have to give them props for making that. That one really surprised me.
And one of my two opens this week. It's called Saving Mr. Banks.
Mm-hmm.
It surprised me because it started awkwardly, and then I got into the flow of it, and I thought it worked pretty well. Until I went home, enthused about the movie, and went online to read more about the real story it was based on. This is about the author of Mary Poppins and the final negotiations for Disney to get the rights to make the film.
Yeah, P.L. Travers.
And I read the real story. And
oh boy.
Boy, was I surprised.
In what ways?
I don't know how to do this without spoiling.
I will. She never liked the film.
Uh-huh.
Basically, she never liked the film. And I think that's one of the reasons why this film is getting slammed is at the end. By the way, they make the movie, so I don't think there's a spoiler alert on this one.
But in the
movie.
Anyone who's got kids knows that they made the movie.
At the end of the film, Emma Thompson cries while watching the movie.
That happened.
Except she cried because she hated it.
Yeah.
Not because she was thinking about her dad, played by Colin Farrell.
And the way that the Disney manipulated the film, it's like she's crying because she's remembering her childhood. She's reconciled what happened to her and what Disney's doing. She's surrounded by Disney people. And it's like she's finally made some sort of peace with it. When in fact, she loathed the film, mm-hmm. talked about how much she hated it for years. Wouldn't allow any sequels to be done, and when they wanted to do a different company wanted to do a musical version in London, she put it into her contract that no Americans could be hired in mm-hmm. any capacity to make sure that no one from Disney snuck through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fundamental dishonesty was the big surprise for me.
We are talking about movies here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or on Twitter at WFYI. Carlos, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Oh, I just wanted to say that I was thinking about that movie came out earlier this year, Pacific Rim.
Mm-hmm.
It just reminded me so much of back in the day when I used to watch the Saturday afternoon monster movies with, and robots. You're talking about movies. I don't think it did real good in ratings, but it was a fun movie. And I also wanted to quickly disagree about Superman. The fight scenes were kind of based alongside the promotion of a video game called Injustice: Gods Among Us, which was a DC-based video game. And if you watch the fight scenes, it looks almost exactly like the fight scenes in the video game.
Thank you very much for the call, Carlos.
Well, Carlos, I'm not going to argue video games versus physics, so there's that. But
I think Carlos's point though was that some of that may have been a marketing decision rather than himself.
If you're telling film critics that some film is like a video, we don't want to hear that.
No.
But he is right about Pacific Rim. Pacific Rim was, I don't know if it was yours, Ed, it was my favorite summer film.
I had a ball at Pacific Rim.
Absolutely.
Almost every reviewer I know had a great time as well.
It's Guillermo del Toro's Valentine to the monster movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a big, loud monster movie. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we complain about when we sit on the front porch and complain about the darn kids and their fast-edited films is if you're going to have a fight scene, and I'm looking at you, Transformers, and other films, if you're going to have a fight scene with two big behemoths beating the snot out of each other, I want to see it. Don't give me close-ups and fast edits and, you know, extreme. And you see it. You see full shots of this giant monster. monster, mechanical monster fighting this real life monster. You know, 30 years ago, it would have been Rick Baker in a suit beating another guy in a suit. And I would have been perfectly happy with that.
Sure.
And Pacific Rim knew the genre, knew those monster movies that we grew up with, and treated it in a loud, expensive fashion, and it was a lot of fun.
So when Carlos and Matt and I go out to the movies, we'll go to an action monster movie, and we'll skip the superhero film.
There you go.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener who says, After Earth and the Canyons are easily the worst movies of the year. Any disagreement?
No, that's one more why I go with most annoying rather than worst, because I don't want to bother talking about them.
Oh, okay. Were either of those on your most annoying list? Or
no, they were just...
You expected them to be bad, and they were. They fulfilled expectations.
Yeah. Will Smith, bless his heart, you want to do a treat for your son, don't make a boring movie and have him star in it. You know, because that's what After Earth is. It's a treat for his boy. You know, and again, the sentiments are kind, but don't inflict it on us. Just watch it at home. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm really wondering when my daughter and your son are going to ask for a $100 million budget movie for them to star in. The Canyons, I actually say, this was, of course, the Lindsay Lohan drama that was based on a Barton Eaton Ellis, the guy who did American Psycho,
Brett Easton Ellis.
So, yeah. And it was directed by Paul Schrader, who is one of my favorite directors. And he was doing this basically as a job for hire. And it's about pretty vapid people in Hollywood doing terrible things to each other. And, it also starred a porn actor named James Dean, D-E-E-N. And he's the Svengali. And, of course, you know, if you're manipulating Lindsay Lohan, that's not that big of a task. I always remember the opening shot is a montage of abandoned multiplexes. Not the old single theaters downtown that you and I grew up with, but the abandoned multiplexes. And I like that. When that's the best part of your movie, it goes down really fast. Just really ugly people. I mean, this is like Bling Ring and Pain and Gain. I just don't need pretty vapid people doing terrible things to each other in my life.
Was it that, I mean, in terms of the worst, would you say, After Earth and the Canyons are there? Or do you have any that
they're in my ten? I actually
top
have,
it in
I
terms of
have
dubious
10
achievement.
Films, yeah, I actually have 10 films that are bad enough, and they're both on there.
Could we run through them real quick?
Sure. Movie 43 we talked about. Lone Ranger we talked about. R.I.P.D., wasn't – I don't think it was the worst film, but it was definitely the laziest film.
Jeff Bridges, too.
And Ryan Reynolds. Yeah. And
I was a little more surprised at Jeff Bridges than
He got a nice check, and he even admitted, it didn't turn out that well. Safe Haven, the Nicholas Sparks movie with Julianne Hough that was ridiculous. Jack the Giant Slayer.
Oh.
Which was no fun whatsoever, and it should have been. The Big Wedding, which was an American remake of a French farce, a wacky wedding. So Robert De Niro, Susan Sarandon, Diane Keaton, Katherine Heigl, Amanda Seyfried, just so they could all work together. That wasn't fun. The Hangover 3, really not necessary at all. There was a few more of those. Canyon. After Earth. Oh, Tyler Perry's Temptation. Yeah, I actually rented a Tyler Perry movie because they don't screen it for the press.
No.
And it was called Confessions of a Marriage Counselor, a film that apparently nobody had ever attended a marriage counselor in their life, and it shows in this film. Really not fun at all.
And how many, in terms of the most annoying, Ed, have we ticked off here?
There's Austin Land, bad comedy about a... basically an Austin-themed resort where people get to go and live out their fantasies, and it's just ineptly done on a surprising scale. Oz the Great and Powerful, because it was flat.
Mm-hmm.
It was just pictures. Mm-hmm. And Star Trek Into Darkness.
Oh, where Brawn beats out over brains in a Star Trek movie.
And where they slap the name Khan on the villain because that'll draw more attention to get more people into the theater, despite the fact that Khan pretty much has nothing to do with the previous con.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So
that's it for mine. Yeah.
All right. Well, we are talking about movies here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. All right. I think we've belabored the bad stuff long enough. Let's talk about the good ones. You know, I know you guys compile lists here of best. So, Ed, how about if you start with, you want to start from the bottom or from the top?
Let me start with the top because that's the only one I'm positive about. The others, I've got to turn in my list for print tomorrow, and I'm going to be juggling it all the way to the last
minute. We're
getting
a preview here. This is good.
But the number one is a movie called Her by Spike Jonze. It comes out locally early in January, and I wish you could see it now. On paper, it sounds trite. Mm-hmm. It's set slightly, very slightly in the future. The latest thing that's come on the market is operating systems that are sentient, that have mm-hmm. actual consciousness built mm-hmm. in. It's the story of Joaquin Phoenix falling in love with his computer operating system. Now, I know it sounds like a bad episode of The Twilight Zone or Outer Limits. It's a wonderful movie. It's beautifully mm-hmm. realized. It zigs when you think it's going to zag. It's the most successful film that Spike Jonze has made to date. And he did Inside John Malkovich and Adaptation. This is a guy who makes, you know...
And Where the Wild Things movies. Are.
Where the Wild Things
Petty
Are.
Petty movies, yeah.
And it's satisfying. I keep reading that it's going to be a tough sell, and I don't understand why, because I thought it was deeply human. I thought the sci-fi aspects were fascinating. It was just a wonderful movie.
Matthew.
My number one is the film All Is Lost. This is the basically the one man Robert Redford show that was written and directed by J.C. Chander, who made Narrow Margin or Margin Gain, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Now I have a question for you.
Yes.
Or Margin Call.
Margin Call. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. How does with the we saw a number of You Are There experience yes. films this year, like Gravity and Captain Phillips to a certain extent.
Yep.
How did you? What is it about All Is Lost that stood out above the other ones for you?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Ed. Mm-hmm. Basically, this is Robert Redford and his yacht, his small yacht, and it sprung a leak. That's mm-hmm. basically it. Mm-hmm. And he's doing anything he can for survival. First thing I thought of was Gravity. It's, I think, more claustrophobic than Gravity. Because he only has like a handful of lines. Robert Redford's character only says about maybe six or seven things. So there's no talking to a volleyball. There's no talking to herself to keep things going like Sandra Bullock did. And I loved Gravity. I really mm-hmm. enjoyed Gravity. But I think part of it for me was you have a better – it seemed more realistic to be lost at sea than lost in space, so mm-hmm. to speak. And we talked about how great vocal work Scarlett Johansson did in Her. This is one of the most physically demanding roles I've seen in a long
yes.
time. And Robert Redford, who's 77, pulls this off. I was more white-knuckled about this film. And this year the theme was do anything to survive. Like you mm-hmm. said, Captain Phillips, 12 Years a Slave, Gravity. And it just really wrenched me in. And I was so tense. And also, it didn't have some folks weren't crazy about the symbolism of gravity. Mm-hmm. There isn't any of that in this. So it's kind of a stripped-down, bare-bones, white-knuckled survivor tale, and I was just absolutely thrilled by it.
And I'm going to stay with you, Matthew. What's second on your list?
12 Years a Slave.
12
which
Years
Which seems to be the front-runner for a lot of folks. That was our number one pick by the Indiana Film Journalists Association. Mm-hmm. We had our intense meeting on Saturday. We announced it on Monday. I mean, this is just a gut-wrenching film. We think we've seen it all between Roots, Django Unchained, unfortunately, or which was fun, and Mandingo, but it takes the concept of slavery and drives it even harder, more realistic, more gut wrenching. Some characters are maybe less three dimensional than others, but it's a painful watch, but I think it's also required watching.
It's good watching. I mean, it's not medicine that's good for you. It goes beyond that. Thanks. Largely to the lead performance,
Chiwetel Ejiofor, who we named as best actor, and he's a guy I've loved his work for a decade. He's kind of been mm-hmm. that guy, and so I'm hoping with this award season, folks are going to know how to pronounce his name correctly. He's really good.
He plays a free man in New York, and by having him kidnapped and taken and made into a slave, it takes you and smacks you into the experience of being captured, being under the thumb of someone else, and then also of what it's like to be a controller.
We are talking about movies here on No Limits. My guests are Matthew Soucy, here of WFYI and Film Sociology, and Ed Johnsonott, Nouveau's film critic. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about movies today on No Limits. Thomas, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I was just wondering what you all thought about Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters. I know you had mentioned R.I.P.D., and I was not actually a fan of that, but it made me think of Hansel and Gretel, and I was actually surprised at that movie. It was pretty good.
As was I. Actually, I have a list of surprises and disappointments.
Thanks very much for the call, Thomas.
Thomas, yeah, I'm with you. And I think what happened, because there's been a number of childhood stories that have been wrenched up into being serious, adult, grown-up, you know, action movies. We talked about Jack the Giant Slayer. And the thing that the marketing of this film failed to do mention was that Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters, and this is Jeremy Renner and Gemma Arterton from Tomorrow. But two of the producers of that film were Will Ferrell and Adam McKay. The guys who gave
us
Anchorman. And there is kind of a wink and a nod to the ridiculous, over-the-top action films. So you have, you know, Famke Janssen is also in it as well. So I would say it's more like Kick-Ass or Machete than, say, The Expendables or Man of Steel. Yeah, it was an over-the-top comedy, but it wasn't marketed that way. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, go rent that. And have fun.
Well, and we've gotten a tweet from a listener who doesn't give us a name, but says, Star Trek Into Darkness was hands down the best movie of the year, followed by The Way, Way Back. So clearly...
Oh, I'm with him on The Way, Way Back. That was a really good movie.
So, but Star Trek, and it shows, you know, how the, and there were people, apparently, I wasn't one of them, who loved The Man of Steel, too.
But, oh, sure.
But...
yeah, well, that's the beauty of this. It's all opinions.
Yeah. And... another one we've gotten says, biggest surprise was Snitch, and the performance of Dwayne Johnson shows he can actually act.
Agreed. And I think you got to stop, and I guess I'm talking to commercial radio and television, you got to stop calling him The Rock. Mm-hmm. If Vince McMahon throws him a check and he does wrestling stuff, that's fine. He's earned the name Dwayne Johnson, and he's been doing it for a while. I mean, even films that aren't necessarily good, like Be Cool or Walking Tall, he's been pretty good in them.
Yes.
Snitch is also on my surprise list. That's kind of a throwback to the old 70s action movies. He plays a guy who goes undercover to get his son out of prison for a crime he didn't commit. Or something like that, but it is that throwback to that.
Yeah, it sounds like Gator or
yeah, right.
Or something
with
like
Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
That's not bad. Maybe Burt should play his dad. But yeah, I absolutely agree. He's gotten so much better over the years, and even in something where he's supposed to be roided up and bulked up like Fast and Furious 6, he's doing fine.
And there was a surprise. I enjoyed Fast and Furious 6. It was, again, it knew what it was, and it did it really well.
Mm-hmm. What are the other big surprises you've got, Matthew?
Let's see. I wrote, I have a thing now called the Grindhouse Rule, where there's a lot of, especially action films, that really should be 70 minutes and no more. And, of course, a lot of them, they're an hour and a half or 2 hours. So films like, I think, Bullet to the Head, the Sly Stallone film that wanted to be an action film from the 80s, or Parker, which was Jason Statham being in a film directed by Taylor Hackford. One that's actually on my list that I wanted to bring up was the remake of Carrie that was supposed to come out in March, and then they pushed it to October, which was a wise move. But the fact that you had the woman who directed Boys Don't Cry, you had two actresses who were really good, Chloe Martz and Julianne Moore, and no disrespect to Piper Laurie and Sissy Spacek, they're actually older apart this time around. Mm-hmm. But it captured the angst between mother and daughter, being bullied in school, and they do tag on a little thing at the beginning and at the end as far as, you know, something that happens at the end of that film in a post-Columbine world. But I really like the performances
and that's
of the
ladies. I haven't seen, I saw the first Carrie years ago, haven't seen the most recent one, and I wondered how that would play out in not just a post-Columbine, but post-Sandy Hook, post-Sandy
Hook. They tag something. It feels like it was tagged on, and they take out the which for me is one of the scariest gotcha endings, which was in the original. But I really like the performances of the ladies in that film.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about movies here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Or you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. David, welcome to the program.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. Three of the best. I appreciate this show.
I wanted to pose a question
concerning 12 Years a Slave. Quite honestly, I walked out of the movie upset. It seemed to be a rehashing of the same old story about slavery that we all know. And the only redeeming grace was Chetoway Edafor in the movie. He was outstanding as usual. There is nobody who can give you a look that will make you think that he's about ready to pull your head off like Chetoway Edafor can.
He's got remarkably expressive eyes.
Yes, his eyes are killer. They are. That's what makes him, is part of the mystique that makes him a great actor. Just wondering what you guys thought was on the way that that has just been rehashed. And although added a bit of the fury, more of the fury on it, the movie itself did not impress me as much as Chetoway Edafor's acting did.
David, let me ask you, besides Django Unchained, when was the last time there was a major film about slavery?
Well, Django Unchained was just made, what, a year ago?
But that's a revenge fantasy film. Before that.
Before that, agreed. And there's a reason for that, because it was a rehashing, and we're constantly rehashing it.
When?
And once again, I just saw that as once again. Even for years, that was rehashed. And it, I mean, when we go back to Roots or any of the others.
That's almost 40 years ago.
Well, and that's okay. I don't care if it's yesterday or 30 years ago. It's still a rehashing of the same ideas and thoughts that we already all know about the brutality of slavery.
Unfortunately,
that's all I'm getting.
Unfortunately, I don't think we all. I think there's a big chunk of the mall crowd these days that don't know.
Well, and some of it, at least in film history, you know, if you think about the film about you know, the Civil War era and the, you know, the antebellum era, it's mm-hmm. Gone with the Wind, which does not have any sort of realistic depiction of what slavery was like.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much for the call and the conversation.
Oh, thank you,
gentlemen.
Good talking to you.
All right, have a great day,
thanks.
Guys.
You too.
Care. So, you know, 12 Years a Slave, this is one of the other things, is that sometimes you got to ask, and we've seen this with some other films, is it Holocaust films, for example, all of that, is it too painful to look at?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a fair...
I just felt like for me, with 12 Years a Slave, I thought I knew more when I walked out. I had a better perspective when I walked out, or a better understanding when I walked out than I had when I walked in.
As did I. And I think the thing of treating people as property.
Yes.
Property. I mean, we've seen relationships between slaves and slave masters, and they've run from the side, you know, the mm-hmm. action partners in Django Unchained to the Harlequin romance novels of Mandingo, where they switch partners of different colors, you know,
mm-hmm.
but nothing quite like this. One of the actresses that was we hope gets an Academy Award, which should get an Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actress. I'm saying her name right, but it's Lupita Nyong'o, who plays a slave that is really under the clutches of the Michael Fassbender character.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taking a relationship and wrenching it up and pushing it a little further than I think it had been done before.
And showing and going into what it's like to be captive,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to have a culture built around you being captive.
Your captivity.
Yeah.
Welcome to the program.
Yes, I had a question specifically
sure.
for Matthew about the film Gravity. I was surprised when I watched it. For me, the film was entirely about its symbolism, but I was surprised talking with my friends and everyone who just felt it was an action film, and I wondered what you thought about the symbolism of the film.
I think a lot of people didn't want to believe it was Sandra Bullock's character being reborn. I mean, there's a reason why she mentions at the beginning of the film that she lost her child.
Mm-hmm.
And then not really giving away a whole lot at the end, but there is something of her... there is a moment of climbing out of something.
It's a resurrection.
Film. Yeah, pretty much. But and I think people sometimes people just want the film to be what it is on the surface. Mm. And even with that, Gravity is a really gripping film. It captures the beauty and the terror of outer space. because of this film, I don't want to hear sounds in sci-fi movies anymore. Mm-hmm. The use of sound mm-hmm. in this film is brilliant. Mm-hmm. And you do have a claustrophobic feel. I mean, it's, you know, I've complained about the films of Paul Greengrass, well, his Bourne films, where I needed Dramamine to watch it. And I didn't need Dramamine watching Gravity. Mm-hmm. And kudos to Sandra Bullock for really carrying this picture. And like I said, it just looked fantastic. Yeah, the bigger the screen you can see this, the better.
We have gotten a tweet from a listener named Adam who lists his best films of the year. About Time, Dallas Buyers Club, Prisoners, Captain Phillips, Gravity, and Kings of Summer. Any disagreement on any of those?
No, particularly on Dallas Buyers Club. That's a powerful, really strong movie with some incredible acting from Matthew McConaughey and Jared Leto.
Mm-hmm. And McConaughey has been we talked about this last year. McConaughey has been on an incredible streak. If you think of
since 2011,
Magic, you know, Lincoln Lawyer, Magic Mike, Killer Joe, Bernie. This year, Dallas Buyers Club, Mud, which is a fantastic kind of Southern Gothic, almost a Tom Sawyer-esque story, and even his one scene in The Wolf of Wall Street, he knocks it out of the park, and he's been able to take the charm that we all like from Matthew McConaughey, and use it into characters that, you know, they make, in some cases, dangerous, mysterious, or even repugnant, and have a little flair, a little charm to them.
So in some ways, once he forgot about making, you know, forgettable romantic comedies, he came into his own and came into his talent.
Yep.
So in terms of your list, I think we made it through the top two. Where's number three?
The Wolf of Wall Street, which opens Christmas Day. Martin Scorsese's new film.
With Leonardo DiCaprio.
Leonardo DiCaprio and who else?
Oh, my gosh, Jonah Hill. And,
people.
It's
almost 3 hours.
Yep.
It's excess almost all the way. It's overwhelming. It's so much fun. There's parts, especially at the very end, there are parts that are just flat out disturbing. I just hope people on Christmas Day, I hope there isn't a, when they make the decision on what film to pick, I hope they choose carefully here. Because if you take the wrong person to this film, there could really be trouble.
You said the same thing last year about Django Unchained, about seeing that on Christmas Day. And that's actually, this is also a really good choice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a terrific. Wow. That's such fun.
People are going to say it's Martin Scorsese's Wall Street. People are going to compare it to the narrative that he did with Goodfellas and Casino. Mm-hmm. What I think he does with this is shows beyond the absurdity of how much money, how much time, how much power that these stockbrokers, many of them crooks, got away with. And that's something that Oliver Stone, Mr. Subtlety, never really showed. And as far as the narrative, there's a couple of fun moments where DiCaprio's character is talking to the audience, trying to explain some technical aspect, and he just stops and goes, "I know you don't care." So he's able to take a little twist of a familiar storytelling point that he's done before. And and you run with it for 3 hours. Mm-hmm. 3 hours.
And your number three is?
My number three film is Alexander Payne's Nebraska. Great performance by Bruce Dern as a old codger drunk who's starting to get into dementia, who thinks he won $1 million because he got a piece of mail saying that he did.
And publisher's clearinghouse type thing.
So he's going to walk from Billings, Montana to Omaha, Nebraska to collect his winnings. And he talks his son, played by Will Forte from SNL, who's also really good in this.
Uh-huh.
And it's an Alexander Payne road film. We've seen his road pictures in Sideways and About Schmidt. But it's more than just a road film. It's more than just father and son trying to bond. It's, this is a guy that this is, I think, his last wish. I compared it to Trip to Bountiful, except, it's Bruce Dern, and it's shot in black and white. And it's a fun time going on this trip with people. And somebody that should be mentioned, June Squibb, who's kind of a that lady, and a character actress that's been around for decades. She plays Bruce Dern's kind of overbearing wife, but she has got one glorious scene that says, for all the nagging we hear from her, she does love her husband in the old-fashioned, doesn't necessarily show it way. But I really, really enjoyed Nebraska.
And your fourth?
Gravity, which Gravity? We already talked about.
We talked about. Did you like? I've heard him talk about Gravity. How about Ed?
I really enjoyed it as well. I've got one that we haven't talked about yet. A documentary called The Act of Killing.
I'm sorry, I lost that.
The Act of Killing.
The Act of Killing. What
Holy
makes it?
Holy smokes!
It's about the genocide in Indonesia in the mid '60s.
It's set now when the filmmaker went and said, got with the men that did the men responsible for the genocide were treated like rock stars by the culture. They were inspired by gangster figures in American movies. And this guy comes and says, I want to make this movie out, and we're going to need to recreate some scenes. So we get to see these monsters who were treated like rock stars by the community restaging their own genocide with the public digging in because they want
to be a part of a film.
Great.
Yeah.
And it's astounding to watch. It's horrifying and mesmerizing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
I remember telling Ed, this is my film nerdism. Werner Herzog did something mm-hmm. similar called Little Dieter Needs to Fly. Mm-hmm. And it's about a POW who returned. I mean, he's a soldier who returns to where his POW camp was in Vietnam. And they recreate some of the stuff like where he was bound and where he was dragged and things like this. But I think The Act of Killing takes that concept and takes it even further by using, yeah, like he said, guys who were treated like rock stars that beheaded people with a wire.
Mm. Mm.
And they recreate this. They recreate this. It's it's one of those things where it has to be real. You couldn't make it up.
So I'm going to switch gears very abruptly here because it is a holiday show. So we got to aim and talk about really holiday films real quickly. We've got, you know, maybe a minute if there's one, you got all of the family gathered. If there is a holiday themed movie that people ought to watch.
Oh, if the family's there, then I can't say Bad Santa. So I'll Ed, go ahead while I think of something else.
Yeah.
Well, Frozen. I mean, which the families are already going to.
That's a good one.
It's a good solid Disney movie. You know, good songs, good characters.
Yeah, I'll agree with that on Frozen. It is every component of the Disney Princess musical.
Okay.
And it's strong on everything. The girl, the comedic sidekick, the comedic horse, the music of the guys who did Book of Mormon did the music. You have Idina Menzel as one of the singing voices. It's one of the best Disney films in a while. But yeah, I think that would be one to check out for the holidays with your family.
I think that'll have to be the last word. Okay. I'd like to thank Matthew Soucy and Ed Johnson-Ott for another provocative discussion of the year's movies. We will be back on Thursday when we're going to be talking about financial planning. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.